He follows the light into the kitchen. A bowl of lemons is centered on the square table. One of the lemons has gone moldy. He wants to pluck it out and throw it in the trash. He thinks about calling Grace down from her bedroom and asking her to remove the bad lemon, but, assuming his diminished voice couldn't reach her anyway, decides not to bother. He walks over to the pizza box on the counter, the lid tilted slightly open. He peeks inside. 3 pieces left. He inhales the smells of peppers and onions and dough, and with a tortured sadness remembers the sensory pleasure of eating, like a lover he'll never kiss again, a piano he'll never play again. He imagines the chewiness of the toppings and cheese, the crunchy bite of the crust, the hot temperature of the tangy sauce and salty cheese in his mouth, the rapid responsive action of his grand piano, his hands in Maxine's thick black hair, his mouth on hers. Almost dizzy with desire, he notices that he doesn't imagine Karina's hair or lips. He tries to remember the last time they kissed, the last time he held her, the last time he got hard thinking about her. He can't find it. His memories of touching her, wanting her, loving her, feel like yellowed, unlabeled snapshots in someone else's scrapbook. Too much time has passed. It's 9:03. Stepping away from the pizza box, he approaches Grace's coffee mug from this morning, next to the sink. He bends over, leans his face into the mug, and inhales whatever he can draw out of the sticky, bittersweet hoop of desiccated coffee at the bottom. He exhales. Nirvana. And pure hell. Desperate, he extends his tongue into the mug, hoping to lick the dry ring, but his tongue isn't long enough, and the mug is too deep. He gives up. The phone numbers for Caring Health, his neurologist, and Bill's cell are written on a piece of paper and held by a magnet to the refrigerator. Next to this is a photograph of Grace and Karina at Grace's high school graduation. They're both wearing black, both beaming. Grace has her mother's smile. There are no other photographs, no other smiling children on what used to be his refrigerator, the son he always wanted, a sister for Grace. All those years trying to get Karina pregnant, believing in her doctor's appointments, jerking off into plastic cups, hoping. None of it was real. Maybe this is why he can't remember loving her. All that time wasted. It's 9:06. With nothing more to explore, he's walking back to the den when he's struck with the sudden out-of-body slow-motion realization that he's falling. He went to step right, but his leg never responded. Something in the interplay between neurons and muscles broke off. Something didn't fire or listen or land. Something let go, unplugged, and the command to walk fizzled out, the connection severed. In the split second before he hits the floor, he's aware that he cannot break his fall and thinks to turn his head, but not soon enough. His chin and nose take the brunt of the impact. Warm blood drains down his right nostril. He can taste its metallic saltiness in his mouth. He registers the pain, throbbing and sharp, mostly at the bridge of his nose, between his eyes. Internally, he scans his limbs, trying to discern if anything is broken. He can't seem to find his right leg. A realization sinks in like liquid concrete funneling into his body, transforming him into immovable stone. Nothing is broken, but he's not getting up. His right leg is gone, consumed by ALS. As he lies face down on the kitchen floor, he knows he'll never walk again. He tries to yell for Grace, but he can barely get enough air into his lungs in this position to breathe, never mind produce loud sound. He lifts his head and tries again.
Grace!
He lowers his head, resting his right cheek on the cold tile floor. A puddle of drool mingled with blood pools beneath his chin. He's not sure he has the strength to lift his head again. He finds the only part of his body still available to him, his left foot. He lifts and drops it over and over, banging his wool-slippered foot against the floor like a foreboding muffled drumbeat. Several minutes pass. Tired, he stops tapping his foot. Panic wants him now. It forms a fist in his stomach, its claw reaching for his throat. He won't be able to breathe if panic takes him. Grace. She comes down every night at 10 for his last feeding and to hook him up to the BiPAP machine, What time is it? It won't be long now. He has to fight against the panic and keep breathing. He's lost in the feeble yet steady rhythm of his inhales and has no sense of how much time has passed when he hears Grace's footsteps. Oh, my God! He opens his eyes and Grace appears over him like an angel. What happened? He doesn't expend his limited energy to state the obvious. Okay, I'm calling 911.
No, he whispers. Please don't.
Why? I'll call Bill or someone at Caring Health. She looks over at the refrigerator, at the phone numbers on the door.
No, it is late.
What if you broke something?
I didn't.
Your face is all bloody. I think you broke your nose.
There goes my modeling career.
I have to roll you over, then. His head is turned to the left. She places a hand on his left shoulder and hip and pulls on him carefully, but with great effort. He assists as much as he can with his left foot, and she finally manages to turn him onto his back. She grabs a dish towel from the counter, runs it under the tap, crouches over him, and wipes his mouth, cheek, and neck. As she scrubs the cloth too roughly against his skin, working to loosen the blood that is dried and crusted on his face, cold water drips down his neck, soaking his back. She's gentler around his nose. She stands up and studies him now. He studies her, too, and can't tell if she's worried, disgusted, or scared. Probably all of the above. I'm not strong enough to get you into bed.
That's okay. I can sleep here.
She folds her arms over her chest. I'll be right back. He sees the light flick on in the den, and a few moments later, he hears the wheels of the BiPAP cart rolling toward him. She wiggles three pillows under his head, adjusts his arms to match their position on either side of his body, and drapes his bed comforter over him. She leaves again. This time, he hears her footsteps running up the stairs. She returns with her pillow, a blanket, and her blue and white gingham comforter. I'll sleep next to you, in case something happens. She plugs in the humidifier and the BiPAP, turns them on, and checks the settings. He doesn't bother to mention that she's forgotten to feed him. He's not hungry. She holds the mask in her hand, and he's afraid of how much it's going to hurt when pressed against the bridge of his nose. I'm sorry I didn't hear you right away.
Don't be sorry. I'm the one who sorry.
For what? He's sorry he didn't give enough of his time to her. He's sorry he's running out of it. He's afraid he doesn't have much left. He's sorry he wasn't a better father to her. He's sorry she didn't feel loved by him. It's now or never.
Everything. I love you, Grace. I'm so sorry.
She closes her eyes, and a gentle closed-lipped smile settles on her mouth. She opens her eyes, and tears stream down her beautiful face. She doesn't wipe them.
I love you too, Dad.
She fits the BiPAP mask over his face, and he endures the screaming pain between his eyes as air flows in and out of his lungs. For the first time in as long as he can remember, he feels peace when he breathes.
Chapter 26. Karina, Elise, and her students are early, sitting at a cluster of four round tables, three chairs at each, huddled in a half moon facing the stage. They're at Snug Harbor Jazz Bistro on Frenchman Street, just outside the French Quarter, tucked away in a windowless, candlelit, cozy room behind the dive bar out front, waiting for the show to start. Tonight features up-and-coming jazz pianist Alexander Lynch, accompanied by drums and a bass, a simple trio. With a background in classical piano and then Broadway, Alexander is new to the jazz scene. Elise saw him in New York at Blue Note in October and can't stop raving about him, says he reminds her of Oscar Peterson. The room hasn't filled in yet. Karina counts 15 tables plus a balcony above them. Their seats are right up front, inches from the stage, which feels intimidating, threatening even, as if she were sitting too close to an open flame, as if being here could be dangerous. She pulls at her lavender silk scarf, spreading it across her front like a bib, covering her cleavage as much as possible. After much angst, she decided to wear her best black dress, spaghetti strapped and tight around the bust, flaring and flowy from the waist to the knees, probably too short and too revealing for her age. She bought it over a decade ago. It fit her better then. She fears she looks like 10 pounds of potatoes in a 5-pound bag. Elise is in jeans and black suede ankle boots, a black velvet blazer over a graphic t-shirt, laughing and chatting with her students totally at ease, as if she were a regular, as if this were her seat, and the club was expecting her. She fits into everything. The students are also in black and jeans, edgy and casual and cool. They belong here too. They're all in their early 20s, about where Karina left off before giving up, still believing it's all possible. Karina slides the bottom olive off the plastic skewer in her martini and chews on it, while Elise leans over to the table to their right. As Elise's back is now to her, Karina can't hear the conversation and feels excluded, out of place, conspicuous. She doesn't deserve to be on this field trip. She's not a teacher at Berkeley. She's not a student. She's not even a real musician. She's Elise's sad, pathetic neighbor. She's an old suburban piano teacher, a has-been, a never-was. Once upon a time, an almost-was. She wants to be home, in her flannel pajamas, reading a book in her living room. But as soon as she imagines being on her couch, she hears Richard calling her from the den. She drags a long sip from her martini and pulls another olive into her mouth with her teeth. It's an enormous relief to be away from him, to have a break from the distressing sound of his struggling to clear a cough, from having to tend to him all day and night. She blinked her eyes open this morning in her hotel bed and felt almost giddy, realizing that she had just slept through the entire night, undisturbed. And then guilt came marching in, stomping with its monster feet and pounding its drum, scaring any nascent feelings of relief and lightness back into their holes. She shouldn't have stuck Grace with him for 4 days. Grace shouldn't have to clean up her father's piss and be up all hours of the night while Karina is well-rested and wearing a poorly fitted black dress, drinking a dirty martini, and listening to jazz with a bunch of kids. What if something goes wrong? "I can't wait for you to hear this guy," said Elise, leaning back over to Karina. "Abby just called him the Mozart of jazz." Karina nods. It's been so long since she's been to any kind of live musical performance. Years since she's been to Symphony Hall, the Hat Shell, Jordan Hall. The last time might have been to see Richard at Tanglewood. He played the Marriage of Figaro overture. 8 years ago? Can it really be that long? She wouldn't feel so uneasy if they were at a concert hall. If she were tucked somewhere safe and civilized in the orchestra or mezzanine section, waiting to hear a recital or concerto. Classical music has always been her home base, her comfort food, her security blanket. At Curtis, she started as a classical pianist, and by 3rd year, her career looked more promising than Richard's. They never acknowledged this aloud, but they both knew it. Her teachers praised her and gave her opportunities normally reserved for seniors or graduates. They did not offer these opportunities to Richard. He congratulated her whenever this happened, but his words were rigid and cold, spoken through his teeth, and would leave her feeling insulted instead of championed. Whenever she privately or publicly surpassed his playing, he'd grow distant and critical of her in other ways. He didn't like her hair. He ridiculed her grammar. He withheld affection, refused sex, and pouted. She craved nothing more than to be loved by him when he felt self-confident and admired in the spotlight. Ironically, the biggest obstacle to his center stage bravado seemed to be her. When they were students, their technical skills were similarly matched. But her playing was emotionally connected and far more mature. While Richard could master the technical complexity of any piece, listening to him play often made her picture the notes on the page, the chords, the key, intellectually appreciating his athleticism, hearing the music as dissected elements rather than a whole. Not until after graduation, when they lived in New York, did something click in him, and he began to play the emotion of a piece, and not simply the notes. She remembers Professor Cohen and the test. Each student was asked to play a piece, but not until Professor Cohen left the classroom. The test was simple. Could the student make the teacher cry in the hallway? The first time Karina took the test, she played Schumann's Fantasiestücke, Opus 12, number 1. She played the closing gesture tender and quiet, and waited, breath held, for Professor Cohen to return. The door opened, and Professor Cohen was smiling with clasped hands and wet eyes. She made him cry several times that semester. Richard never did. She discovered jazz first semester of her senior year. She breezed into the campus coffee house for a quick espresso, on her way to something else, and stayed for 2 hours, mesmerized by three of her classmates, a trio of piano, drums, and trumpet, playing Miles Davis. This music was so different from the sacred, rigid exactness of Mozart or Chopin. It had an exhilarating freedom, a playful exploration outside the structure of the melody. She watched the three improvise, detour, collaborate, creating something original, discovering the music as they played it, following a free association, a harmony, an embellishment, wherever it led them. They generated momentum, a magical chemistry, a river that flowed through everyone there. Her heart was captivated, dizzy, spellbound. She doesn't think her relationship with Richard would have lasted beyond graduation if she hadn't discovered jazz. In abandoning classical piano for jazz, she ensured that they would never compete, that the classical spotlight would be his to shine in. But switching from classical piano to jazz wasn't an easy transition. Jazz is complex and in many ways technically more difficult than classical piano. And her decision was at best frowned upon, more often snubbed and mocked. Although neither genres are mainstream music, the world of classical piano was privileged and white, played in grand symphony halls to audiences who sip champagne. The jazz world is historically poor and black, played in hole-in-the-wall nightclubs for patrons drunk on bourbon. Alexander, the drummer and the bassist, take the stage, and the audience applauds while the musicians ready themselves at their instruments. Alexander is slender, about Karina's age, with a mop of glossy black hair and fingers that extend for miles, poised on the keys like a sprinter in the blocks, ready to explode into action, holding for the gun to fire. Alexander nods, and the three begin. The melody is a simple repetition, a catchy, easy-breezy tune, but soon breaks into improvised solos. As Alexander plays, Karina closes her eyes, and the notes become a summer evening stroll down a country road, drenched in moonlight, more of a mood than a melody, sultry and slow, in no hurry at all. Softened by vodka, she rides the notes, allowing herself to be carried, and her blood is flowing hotter. She's turned on. Karina remembers living on East 6th Street in New York City, hanging around the Village Vanguard, listening to Branford Marsalis, Herbie Hancock, Sonny Rollins, and Brad Meldow, learning through listening, watching, asking, performing, and improvising. Learning jazz was a three-dimensional experience of unique expressive discovery, lived and breathed on the fly in spontaneous jam sessions. Learning classical piano had been an academic exercise in practice techniques, adherence to strict rules, memorizing the notes on the page, practicing alone. She never felt more challenged, more alive, than when she was playing jazz. The next two pieces are high energy, a call to action and celebration. Alexander's fingers are a fiddler crab running from a seagull's pursuing shadow, a hummingbird drinking nectar from the keys, trilling arpeggios inhabited by God. He's traveling low to high on the keyboard, coloring outside the lines, hitting notes that land just shy of displeasing. This is renegade music, exciting, provocative. "Holy shit, right?" says Elise. Karina nods. She closes her eyes again during the fourth piece, entranced by Alexander's riffs, the way his chord extensions wander from the head. He's playing outside now, and the song becomes about the journey, not the destination, about getting lost along the way and what he might discover, an embellished grace note, an ascending harmonic progression, a meandering Sunday drive. He varies the phrasing, changing the shape and texture, inserting blue notes and trills that sound like children laughing. He dances across the keys, chording the notes, loving them, and the music is a gentle morning rain playing on a window pane, delicate, lonely, longing for a lover, a childhood friend, a mother. The song ends, and the audience applauds. Karina opens her eyes, and tears spill down her face. She's enraptured, changed, remembering who she is. She is a jazz pianist. With stunning clarity, she suddenly sees the role she's been playing, the costume and mask she chose and has been wearing for 20 years. She's been hiding, an imposter, unable to give herself permission to do this, to play jazz, to be who she is, shackled inside a prison of blame and excuses. At first it was all Richard's fault for moving them to Boston. Jazz pianists live in New York, not Boston. Then Richard started traveling. He was hardly ever home. They rarely had sex anymore. She needed to refill her birth control pill prescription, but it was February and so cold outside, and she didn't feel like walking to the pharmacy. She was lazy. She was stupid. She was pregnant. Her excuse then chassé'd over to grace and motherhood. Now she couldn't be a jazz pianist because her baby needed her. Richard still spent much of the year touring. She was essentially a single mother. She was consumed and devastatingly lonely in the demands of young motherhood. There was often no room for a shower, never mind for getting back to playing jazz. So she tended to Grace full-time, creating a safe nest where Karina could hide. She promised herself it would be a temporary shelter. Karina remembers her mother, born in an oppressed country, stuck in an economically depressed town by her husband's meager coal mining wages, trapped in a bad marriage by her religion, confined within the dirty beige walls of her small home, raising 5 children. Every day she wore a dingy white apron, her prematurely gray hair pulled into a bun, resignation in her eyes, and her arthritic hands to the bone, cooking and cleaning and tending to the needs of her children, whose singular dreams were to leave that house, that town, that country, as soon as they could. They all left her. Karina swore she wouldn't repeat her mother's life. As much as Karina loved being Grace's mother, she would not bear child after child, adding brick after brick to the wall of her maternal prison. Grace would be her only child, one and done. But Richard wanted many children, a big family. Her carefully buried deception peeks out from its hiding space for the briefest moment, long enough for shame to seep through the walls of her stomach, sickening her. She drains her martini, distracting her tortured, guilty mind with the cozy warmth of booze. When Grace turned 5 and went to kindergarten, Karina would have the time to pursue jazz. That was the plan. But then Grace went to school, and Karina's excuse migrated back to Richard. She discovered charges for an expensive dinner and drinks for 2 on his credit card bill, salacious text messages from some woman named Rosa on his phone, a pair of black lace panties in his suitcase. Not a gift for her. At first, these betrayals shattered Karina's heart. She felt stunned, gutted, humiliated, dishonored. She wept and raged and threatened divorce. And then after a few days of wild emotion, she would feel wrung out, calm, and strangely satisfied. Over time, her heart hardened to it all. She almost craved the detective work, the thrill of finding the next damning text message, the momentary drama it awakened in her, and ultimately, the narrative it supplied. Grace was in first grade, eighth grade, a sophomore in high school, and Karina painted herself the victim, trapped in a bad marriage, by the rules of a church she no longer believed in but still obeyed, and the barbed wire reasons of her own making. She carefully constructed her life, creating a predictable stability in her safe career as a teacher, teaching students to play classical piano in the private confines of her suburban living room, where her students have always been too young, unformed, and musically naive to question her, stretch her, or push her outside her comfort zone. And she could blame Richard and his affairs for holding her back. He was wrong and bad, and she was right and good. And she could resent him for her unfulfilled dreams of playing jazz. And this was the perfect excuse. The brilliant smokescreen deflecting anyone who might inspect the situation for the truth. The truth is, she was terrified of failing, of not making it, of never being as recognized and loved as an artist as Richard is. But then she got divorced and Grace went to college. Her excuse is literally out the door. With seemingly no one left to blame, she pointed her finger at the hands of time. Too much had passed. Her chance had passed. It was too late. She watches Alexander on the stage, new to the jazz scene, about her age. And that last pin falls. She can now see that every collapsed excuse she abided to, like God's commandments, existed only in her mind. Her unfulfilled life has always been a prison of her own making. The thoughts she chose and believed, the fear and blame, paralyzing her in her unhappiness, telling her that her dreams were too big, too impractical, too unlikely, too hard to achieve, that she didn't deserve them, that she shouldn't want them, that she didn't need them. These dreams of playing jazz piano were for someone else, someone like Alexander Lynch. Not for her. As she listens to Alexander play, she steps out of the carefully constructed, now unlocked cage in her mind. She hears him messing with the melody, accenting the ascending chords and varying the phrasing, and she feels the exuberant curiosity in his improvisation, searching for something new, unafraid, and his freedom becomes hers. She sees what's possible for her, if she dares to claim it. The trio finish their final piece of the night, stand and bow. The audience is on its feet, applauding, begging for more as the musicians humbly exit the stage. Karina wipes the tears from her eyes, in between claps, feeling breathless, cracked open, pulsing with desire. And although she's not quite sure how, ready to live.
Chapter 27. Richard wakes from having dozed off, parked upright in his wheelchair in front of the TV, wishing he could be reclined. Although the TV has been on since this morning when Bill set him up here, he stopped watching it at least a couple of hours ago. His heavy head is tipped down, chin to chest, and rolled right, and he doesn't have the neck muscle strength to correct it. His towel bib has fallen off his chest, and the front of his shirt is soaked with drool. His eyeballs are still tired from straining to look up and left to see the TV, so he stares at the floor, where his eyes and head are pointed, and listens to Judge Judy, surrendering to what is. He's in the Maserati of power wheelchairs, front-wheel drive with two motors, it's tricked out with mag wheels, 8-inch casters, a tilt-in space reclining feature, and a hand-operated joystick that comes standard with this model. But because he has no hands, he has no way to control it. He ordered it so long ago when he still had the use of his left hand, when he could still play the piano, when he could still hope that he'd never actually need the chair. He's in the driver's seat of a sexy sports car, unable to place his hands on the steering wheel or step his foot on the gas, forever parked in the garage. There are tech devices that would allow him to control the wheelchair with his chin or tongue or even his breath, but Karina and Richard haven't ordered anything. The activation energy is a mountain precipice. Too many insurance forms, the astronomical cost despite any coverage, the wait to receive the device. It's probably hard for anyone associated with Richard to invest time or money in his ability to move his chin or tongue. How much longer will he be able to breathe? Ordering a wheelchair operating device powered by breath begs an answer to that question, and Richard would rather not ask it. So he's trapped wherever someone parks him, mostly here, in front of the TV or in the living room. He can't leave the house until the ramp is completed because his chair doesn't fit through the door to the garage. For some absurd reason, the loss of his legs took him and Karina by surprise. It shouldn't have. Bill and the other home health aides from Caring Health, his physical therapist, Kathy DeVillo, and his neurologist all told them, warned them, practically begged them to build the ramp sooner rather than later. Don't wait. They blew it off. Richard truly believed he might never need the damn chair. He'd been wearing the ankle-foot orthotic on his right foot quite comfortably for so long, and his left leg seemed to be in good shape. He formulated his own highly unscientific, clinically unproven theory that the disease had arrested, rendered permanently dormant in his legs, and threw his faith into this theory like a religious zealot. He would never lose his legs. Amen and hallelujah. Shortly after ALS severed his right leg from his control, his left leg threw up its white flag. Paralysis settled in rapidly, as if someone had pulled the stopper at his ankle, and all the sand came pouring out. Sitting in his wheelchair, staring at the floor and unable to leave the house, it's clear now. No part of him is safe from this disease. He hoped they wouldn't have to spend any money on an unwanted construction project. An ugly, utilitarian ramp extending from the front door to the driveway, announcing his handicap to the world. Thankfully, his condo finally sold last week, so he can afford the ramp. He'd much rather leave that money to Grace. So, here he sits, Mr. Potato Head without arms or legs, a bobblehead on a breathing torso. His neck is too weak to hold his head up reliably, especially later in the day, making use of the head mouse even when he's wearing a neck collar, an exercise in frustrating madness. So he's disconnected from his computer until they get the Toby eye-tracking technology device. It's been ordered. He's down to 120 pounds from 170, physically disappearing, and yet he's taking up more and more space. This wheelchair, the hospital bed, the BiPAP machine, the shower chair, the Hoyer lift that should arrive any day now. Transferring him from the bed into the chair in the morning and from the chair into bed in the evening is a massive chore that requires great strength and trained technique. Despite how slight and fragile his mass is, he's dead weight, like a sleeping child. Karina can't do it. Bill has been coming for two shifts since Richard lost his legs, morning and evening, using all his muscle and height and a gait belt to lift Richard's body safely from point A to point B. The Hoyer lift, which looks like a cross between an exercise machine and a hammock swing, will make it possible for anyone to safely move him in and out of bed. He hears the doorbell ring. Just weeks ago, this might have been the sound of him stepping on the call button taped to the floor by his bed, but now it can only be the actual doorbell at the front door. He hears men's voices and the sound of something being rolled into the living room. It must be the lift. A few minutes later, Bill's legs and feet appear before Richard. "Hey, Ricardo, let's get you out here. Karina has something for you." Bill says this with unbridled exuberance, like a parent about to present a small child with a special gift. "Oh, goody, a Hoyer lift, just what I've always wanted." Bill rights Richard's head back into position against the headrest, and an enormous relief washes through Richard like warm water. Bill wheels him out into the living room. Richard stares at a grand piano in front of the bay windows, facing the street where the couch should be. Karina is beaming.
What? I saved it,
says Karina.
Is that my?
I couldn't let someone else own your piano. He can't believe she did this. It's incredibly thoughtful and sweet and well-intentioned, but seeing his piano again, after he'd already said goodbye and made peace with never seeing or touching or hearing it again, turns him inside out, as if he's just unexpectedly bumped into an ex-lover in the living room, still not over her. He's all emotion and no words, choked up. Karina and Bill stare at him, expectant, hoping for joy. He wants to give it to them, searching for a way. He looks at his piano, his beloved, from across the room. He can't bear for them both to be paralyzed, still silenced.
Will you play for me?
It'll need to be tuned.
That's okay.
Karina hesitates. She's never played his piano. His piano was his. He smiles and sends her a long blink, his version of permission and please. She acquiesces, sits at the bench, hands poised over the keys, and pauses. She twists around to face him.
What do you want me to play?
He thinks, his favorites all raising their hands emphatically like eager students who know the answer. Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Debussy, Liszt.
Pick me, pick me.
Too many choices crowd his head. Karina, sitting at his piano, waits for an answer. She's waiting to play. She's been waiting for 20 years.
Play me some jazz.
This time Karina smiles and slow blinks, her version of a nod, a thank you, and the energy in her gesture is passed between them, a moment of invisible yet palpable connection. She breaks the spell, thinking now, deciding what to play, her eyes scanning upward as if reading her own mind. She grins.
I'll do Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Bill, you want to sing?
Do Happy Little Bluebirds Fly?
Hell yeah, I'm singing.
Bill scooches next to Karina on Richard's bench. Karina begins to play, setting the mood in a prelude before the lyrics begin. Richard expected her rendition to be loungy, predictably ragtime, upbeat and swingy, but she slows it all down instead, dwelling on the notes, adding interesting chords and embellishments, and he's genuinely surprised, impressed, enjoying it. She's into the melody now, and Bill is singing. Their rendition is restrained and romantic. It evokes a gentle sadness, a fond memory of a lost love. It's a dreamy lullaby, easily the most beautiful song Bill has ever sung. Richard listens to Karina play and Bill sing, and instead of feeling grief-stricken or jealous that he'll never play his piano again, he feels, strangely, happy. He's setting his piano free, letting it go, sending it off on its next journey without him. Then, as Karina plays the final phrasings and his heart moves with the notes, it occurs to him that it's not his piano he's letting go of, setting free. It's Karina. Chapter 28. The Hoyer lift still hasn't been delivered, and until it gets here, Bill is the lift. He's singing Madonna's Like a Prayer while securing a gate belt around Richard's legs, just above the ankle. It's evening, and Bill has already brushed Richard's teeth and washed his face. Even though Richard won't go to sleep for another 5 hours, it's time to get him from the wheelchair to the bed. Richard is Bill's last patient of his shift, and Bill is Richard's last hired help of the day, and Karina can't get him out of the chair, so to bed he goes. Bill weaves a second gate belt around Richard's torso and secures it snug around him while Karina looks on. Bill grabs the suction wand from the rolling cart next to him, flicks the machine on, and vacuums out the saliva pooled in Richard's mouth. Bill has learned through experience to do this prior to moving Richard, otherwise the puddle of saliva waiting in Richard's mouth tips forward when he's vertical, spilling out and onto Bill. His job is not for the squeamish. He then fits a soft cervical collar around Richard's reclined neck so his head won't flop forward. He arranges Richard's socked, belted feet parallel on the pivot disc, A human-sized Lazy Susan placed at the base of his chair, adjacent to his destination, the bed. It takes a grown man and all this time and equipment to move him a few inches. Bill squats in front of Richard like an Olympic skier.
1, 2, 3.
Bill pulls on the gate belt around Richard's chest with his right hand while lifting him under the shoulder with his left. And in a forceful snap, Richard is standing on his paralyzed legs. The extensor muscles in his legs are spastic and rigid, making it possible for him to bear his own weight. While completely unresponsive to any voluntary command, like a child's plastic action hero figure, he can be stood up if balanced properly. Bill lifts and rests Richard's arms atop each of Bill's shoulders to keep them from hanging down and pulling painfully on Richard's shoulder sockets. Bill's biceps are positioned under Richard's armpits, his hands clasped around Richard's back. Richard stands slightly taller, but they're pretty much eye to eye.
My friend David would be so jelly if he knew I got to slow dance with you like this every night. He has such a crush on you.
Richard raises his eyebrows, requesting more information. He saw you play at BSO 3 years ago. I almost went with him. Isn't that funny? I almost knew you before I knew you. The belt around the bottom of Richard's legs keeps his ankles from rolling out. Without it, he'd be standing on top of his ankle bones instead of the bottom of his feet. Bill keeps him balanced on his feet for at least a minute before moving him along, somehow intuiting how delicious this feels, to be stretched out and vertical, his bones stacked and bearing weight, like finally standing after a transatlantic flight in a cramped plane seat. Richard's been sitting in this chair in the same position for 8 hours. Richard sighs, enjoying the sweet relief of being an erect structure, visiting the memory of being an upright man. Their slow dance ends when Bill spins Richard 90 degrees on the pivot disc, so that his butt is now up against the bed. Using the gait belt around Richard's middle, Bill lowers him carefully onto the mattress. As always, Bill sticks the landing.
"I still think I could do that," says Karina.
"I've been doing this a long time, honey. I make it look a lot easier than it is, believe me. You don't want to drop him. You could both get hurt. Wait for the Hoyer. It should be here any day." Bill tugs on each side of the slide sheet, squaring Richard's body in the center of the bed, and arranges Richard's arms and legs like flowers in a vase. Reaching over to the bedside table, Bill grabs what looks like a 1-liter clear plastic water bottle. He reaches under Richard's boxer shorts, pulls out his penis, inserts it into the bottle, and waits a few seconds. As usual, nothing happens. The waiting was just a courtesy. Bill then pushes down on Richard's abdomen with the heel of his hand, pressing firmly on his bladder over and over as if he were pumping water from a well. It works, and the bottle slowly fills with urine. Karina looks away, trying to offer a sense of privacy, a strange and futile gesture. Richard's body parts are in varying states of nudity and being handled all day long. He's showered, toileted, wiped, washed, dressed, and undressed. His body is simply another task to complete, a job to do. His naked body is treated neutrally by every home health aide, every visiting nurse and physical therapist, a thin layer of a latex glove between his skin and actual contact with another human being. His is just another penis, just another saggy ass, just another patient's decrepit body. So Karina doesn't need to look away. He's just another ex-husband with ALS. When his bladder is emptied, Bill tucks Richard's penis back into his boxers and leaves the den to wash the bottle in the bathroom. Now Karina takes over. She lifts Richard's t-shirt, attaches a syringe of water to his Mickey button, and flushes the line. Normally refreshing, the water feels alarmingly cold in his belly. She then switches to a pouch of liquid gold. "Okay, you two." Bill is now wearing his hat and coat. "I'm off like a slutty prom dress." He gives Karina a one-armed hug and a kiss on the cheek. "Be good," he says to Richard. "See you tomorrow."
"Thank you, Bill," says Karina.
Richard slow blinks. It's the end of the day. He's too tired to form words. Karina presses slowly and steadily on the syringe plunger, delivering Richard's liquid dinner into his stomach. The entire meal takes about a half hour, and they usually have the TV on to keep them company, occupied, and safely distracted, but today the TV is off. Bill's singing must have snagged a circuit in Karina's brain. She's humming "Like a Prayer" while she stares vaguely at the wall, a slight smile on her lips. He wonders what she's thinking about. She's had a lightness about her since she returned from New Orleans. He hears her singing pop songs while cooking in the kitchen and noodling jazz riffs on her piano in the mornings. He's been catching her face enjoying distant daydreams. Her energy has changed. Her presence feels less heavy, less oppressive, happier, hopeful even. And while he can't put his paralyzed finger on the reason for it, this unexplained shift in her has provoked a corresponding shift in him. He watches her face, and he recognizes her again, the woman he fell in love with so long ago. She's feeding him, taking care of him, and what he'd been selfishly viewing as an act of martyrdom or duty, he suddenly sees as an act of love. His heart swells, overwhelmed, and as she hums Madonna, he remembers the first time he heard Karina's voice, her Polish accent, how desperate he felt to hear her speak to him, his delight when she finally did. He stares at her green eyes, her amused mouth, and hopes she catches him looking at her. Just like all those years ago, he aches for her to speak to him. He's never told her that he's sorry for cheating on her, for hurting her, for stealing that smile from her lips for so long. But he is sorry, and hopes that she somehow knows this, that she can sense the regret and apology in him the way he can sense this new joy in her. He wants to hear her voice tell him that she's okay. He wants to be forgiven. He wants. The syringe is emptied. Karina refills it with a second helping. As she's reattaching it, her warm, gloveless hands touch his bare, concave stomach, and although from her perspective her hands are in the business of feeding her ex-husband through a peg tube, for Richard, the touch feels intimate, personal, human. At first embarrassed, he hopes she doesn't notice that he's hard beneath the bedsheet and his boxers, but then he hopes she does. Every day he wakes to morning wood and could do nothing but wait it out. He hasn't masturbated since his left hand left him in October. He purposefully no longer imagines anything sexually desirable during this daily rise and fall, but now, as he's unexpectedly turned on, he imagines Karina touching it, touching him, and his desire is excruciatingly urgent, building in his penis, his heart, and his mind, silently begging for her to notice. He wants her to lie down next to him, to kiss him while stroking him. He wants to be a man and not a failing body in a bed. He wants to be touched, to be loved, to come. It's been so long. He wants. She finishes the syringe, flushes the tubing with water, and caps the Mickey button. She lowers his shirt, pulls the covers up to his chest, and stands. Okay, you're good until 10. You want the TV on? He stares at her unblinking. You want anything? He smiles. If only he had the strength to tell her. She hesitates, eyeing him quizzically. Okay, I'll check on you in a bit. She leaves the door to the den cracked open. He sits in bed and stares at the open door, listening to the sounds of her making her own dinner in the kitchen. Wanting. Chapter 29. Richard sits in his wheelchair in the living room where Karina left him about a half hour ago, where he'll stay until Karina or the next home health aide moves him. She parked him in a rectangular patch of sunlight, angled toward the windows, as if a warm and sunny view of Walnut Street is supposed to make him feel more optimistic, less trapped. He knows she's well-intentioned. He watches the blithe movement of squirrels and birds. Everything alive moves. He hears Karina sneeze 3 times. She's been fighting a cold for the past week, staying away from him as much as possible so as not to infect him. She's in the kitchen cooking breakfast. Triggered by the torturously delicious smells of coffee and bacon, saliva pools in his mouth. He gurgles on it and swallows over and over, trying to push the gluey liquid down, struggling not to choke. A string of sticky drool descends over his bottom lip and lands on the cotton towel draped over his chest like a bib for this very reason. He turns his head left and right, but the spider web of drool won't break. He gives up. He shifts his focus away from the sun and animated existence and instead looks upon his Steinway. 88 glossy black and white keys. God, what he wouldn't give to touch them. 10 feet in front of him. 1,000,000 miles. He stares at it with agonizing desire and apology, as if he's broken a sacred promise, a marriage vow. He imagines the action of each key, the blending colors of sound, music coming into existence, birth through his body. He imagines a series of ascending arpeggios, and they become the sound of Karina's laugh. His piano. The relationship is over. He's still working on letting it go. It's not you. It's me. Taking the blame doesn't change a thing. They are divorced, rejected, and abandoned, reduced to pitiful statues collecting dust in the living room. Careful not to tip his head even slightly downward, else it flops forward, chin to chest, unable to right itself. He stares at his legs, his feet angled toward each other, pigeon-toed, and he suddenly resents Bill for arranging his feet in this unmanly way, a body position that speaks uncertainty, meekness, submission. Then he laughs at himself, as if anything about an emaciated man dying of ALS in a wheelchair could possibly communicate machismo, as if anyone but his piano were in the room to judge him. Bill dressed Richard's feet this morning in thin wool socks and black loafers, shoes on a man whose feet will never again walk this earth. The irony and tragedy of wearing shoes make him want to cry. He can't stand to look at his feet. Literally. Instead, he studies the rubber flesh of his flat right hand, limp and lifeless, his curled, distorted left hand, no longer possessed by him, both placed on pillows over the arms of his wheelchair in exactly this position by Bill over an hour ago. Richard's entire body is a costume discarded, the party over. He returns to what used to be his elegant left hand and commands the fingers to straighten, knowing they won't. He changes tack. Please. His limbs are petulant children, unreachable through begging, bribery, ultimatums, or sweet talk. He tries to imagine the war beneath his skin, the invaded countries of his neurons and muscles overwhelmed, decimated, the neutral territories of bone, ligament, and tendon rendered useless by the horrific destruction surrounding them. His entire body is detaching, unzipping from his soul. He turns his head 90 degrees left, then right, testing himself, relieved that he can still do this. Once his neck and voice are paralyzed, he'll be reduced to eye gaze technology and a computer-generated voice for communicating. He opens his eyes wide and pinches them shut tight. Good. When he can no longer blink, he'll be locked in. He doesn't want to die, but he hopes he dies before that happens. Maybe that won't happen. He can feel his tongue wriggling inside his mouth, undulating as if a family of earthworms were dancing within it, celebrating a rainstorm. When he speaks, his tongue feels thick, the volume thinned and barely audible. His words, once a finely detailed painting, are painfully slow to produce and almost impossible to comprehend, strangled and lacking consonants. A Pollock piece. Free jazz. Already compromised to what Dr. Goldstein says is now 39% forced vital capacity, every single inhale is a struggle. Every exhale is incomplete. He's forced to sip air a teaspoon at a time when he's desperate to gulp it down by the gallon, each taste an agonizing disappointment, evidence of the withering muscles surrounding his ribs, his abdomen, his diaphragm. Pulling in enough air to simply sit motionless in the wheelchair is conscious, draining work. He's probably close to needing the BiPAP 24/7, but won't admit this aloud or even request it for purposes of a temporary rest during the day. He won't let anyone advance his wheelchair 1 inch onto the handicap ramp of that slippery slope. Even now, every single night, he still can't believe this is his reality. He's traded bed partners, beautiful women, for a BiPAP. It's the worst monogamous relationship of his life, and they can never break up. Without the BiPAP at night, he might retain too much carbon dioxide in his sleep and suffer brain damage or suffocate and die. He doesn't want to die. He opens his mouth wide and closes it several times, regrettably sensing a new and unmistakable slackness in his jaw. And so it begins. Once the weakness ensues, there is no abortion, no retreating, only a relentless, insidious, icy downward luge into paralysis. Soon, his jaw will hang open. Ribbons of saliva will continually stream over his bottom lip, and he won't be able to talk. He frowns as he imagines this likely development, the impossible-to-mask spectrum from pity to disgust in Karina's and Bill's and every stranger's eyes when they look at him. He doesn't even want to face his piano like that. When will this next irreversible insult be inflicted? Tomorrow? Next week? End of the month? This summer? The answer is yes. He studies his hands that will never again look familiar to him, fingers that used to carry exquisite strength and agility, that a year and a half ago played 87 pages of Brahms, one without error. He misses playing Brahms, feeding himself lunch, scratching his nose, touching a woman, making Karina laugh. He apologizes to his beloved piano for abandoning it, to Karina for abandoning her, and he suddenly feels the cumulative weight of every single loss all at once, like a concrete slab dropped onto his chest. And he can't breathe. Without the slab on his chest, every inhale was already an intended dive into open ocean, stopped dead in ankle-deep water. Now, suddenly, the tide has gone out. He's gasping, drowning on dry land. He can feel the adrenaline kick, the fight-or-flight animal instinct. This is life-threatening. More air now! Yet he can't run, and he can't fight, and he can't get more air now. He tries to use his next exhale to call for help, but he succeeds only in spitting. Karina's in the kitchen drinking coffee, and he's dying in the living room without notice. Inhale. Exhale. His body is seized, the tendons and muscles of his neck squeezing, shaking violently with effort. Each breath feels like drawing air through a thin, clogged straw. It feels like suffocating. Fear rises in his throat where oxygen should flow. He swallows, choking on it. Breathe in. Breathe out. Shallow sips. He's so hungry for air. His cells are literally starving for oxygen. Keep breathing. He calls up what it took to master Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3. 10 grueling hours every day, relentlessly focused, playing each movement over and over, fighting through excruciating physical pain and mental exhaustion until he could play the entire piece by memory and without error. Now his tenacity, his will, his purpose is trained on breathing. In. Out. This is now his song to play. He is not this paralyzed body, these screaming lungs, this primal fear. He will be an instrument of breathing. Breathe. Again, pull the air in. Push it out. Again, it's not enough. He's fatigued, strangled, starving for air, failing. A few short and long months ago, playing piano was like breathing to him. Now breathing is breathing to him, his work, his purpose, his passion, his existence. He has to keep breathing. He doesn't want to die. Chapter 30. Karina panicked and called 911. Richard was intubated in the ambulance by a woman with intensely focused blue eyes and a raised coffee-bean brown mole above her right brow. He never lost consciousness and kept his eyes on hers while she worked on him. Insertion of the endotracheal tube was violently swift and invasive, and the gagging, discomforting pressure of the first few moments was quickly eclipsed by the massive relief of air moving in and out through his windpipe. Once in the ER at Mass General Hospital, someone drew blood, and he had a chest X-ray, which revealed pneumonia. A nurse ran an intravenous line of antibiotics, and he's now in the ICU with Karina, waiting for Kathy DeVillo. Karina is standing next to him, over him, her arms crossed as if hugging herself, watching him intently, studying him, which worries him because he's not doing